All right, well, let's return to our teaching series on hospitality tonight. This is our seventh installment, and I think we're going to be finished up with our next one, the eighth one. I'm going to be kind of, in the next one, you know, kind of bring some of my own practical kind of suggestions, reflections from my reading, and then hopefully we have a practical discussion after that. So just in terms of the kind of how-tos or maybe ideas you guys have had for what it means to take some of these things and practice them in the 21st century. But tonight I kind of want to finish up, before we get to the really practical stuff, to be finishing up on some more models of hospitality. So I'm going to be doing this on, you know, modern models of hospitality, and beginning with John Calvin. That might not sound terribly modern to you, but I'm not really sure how else to break it up, so we're just going to call him modern. But, you know, we kind of considered a couple weeks ago just the priority that the church fathers placed on hospitality, and we've reflected on some of the quotes from them. John Chrysostom was one of them. He was a really key figure who wrote and taught on the topic. And what we're going to do here, just as we kind of get started here, is that see that, you know, there was the same level of appreciation that was, you know, recovered by Calvin, Luther, and then I have a quote as well from the primary author of our catechism, Zacharias Ursinus. We're kind of move on from there, and then we mentioned a couple of very practical ways that hospitality has been practiced, and then kind of close up shop for this session on modern models of hospitality. So begin with John Calvin tonight. And again, I don't want you to think that we have to agree with everything I'm going to talk about tonight, but just, I don't agree with everything I'm going to mention tonight, but just thinking about different ways he'll practice it to kind of help us think outside the box a little bit. And so that's kind of where we're going to kind of go. But so first with John Calvin, I think one of the things that we probably fail to appreciate about the Reformation is that it was a time of real societal upheaval. I know that, you know, you lived in Geneva for a period of time, and you know, you've probably seen, you know, Travel Channel shows and people going to, like, Rick Steves going to Europe and so forth, and you kind of see Europe as this kind of like idyllic place, this kind of trip back in time, and it seems very quaint to us. But if you think about what was going on with the Reformation, you have a time where people were being dislocated from their from farms and from towns and from houses that they had owned and that had possibly been in their families for generations. But then as there was a sort of a religious restructuring of Europe, all of a sudden it became a punishable offense to be reformed and to live in one place. You had to pick up and leave almost overnight with all of your belongings and just get out of Dodge, because the next day you could be killed or locked up or something like that. So within this kind of a society where people are moving and fearful for their lives, you have a time where, you know, Geneva, if I recall, was maybe, that was like maybe 15,000 people at the time of Calvin. Is that, any idea on that? Okay. I think it's about 15,000 people. So that's not that big. And so, but then over the course of a short period of time, you end up having thousands of refugees there who are traveling and fleeing for their lives. So you can kind of imagine like what that does to a city. You have a city then where you have the original occupants of Geneva who are not French originally. There's a Swiss, I think called Canton is I think what they're called. And they didn't like the French, but then predominantly the French were flocking in because Geneva's right against France, and the French were beginning to persecute the Christians, the Protestants, the Reformed. And so Geneva became a natural destination for them. And so you have the people who are the, you know, the original Genovese, I think is what they're called, or something like that. And you have French coming in. Supposedly they had the same faith, but they had different cultures. And as we kind of know within the American context right now, there is always a tension going on with, you know, what happens when a new population moves in with different work skills. And you can easily take jobs from other people who are the, you know, or there originally. So it's a very difficult time. Furthermore, you don't just have this dislocation, but you have people, women and children oftentimes, who became widows and orphans because fathers could be killed for the faith. They're more likely to be killed, the men. And so you end up having a lot of widows and children, orphans, who were by themselves and in urgent need of resources. So a drain on local resources, drain on economy, traditions being threatened. But if you were to go back into to read Calvin, is one of the recurring themes in his teaching was the importance of hospitality, especially toward Christians, toward fellow Christians. He identified even in his own time that he lamented the fact that inns, hotels, inns, now supply the place of accommodations for strangers. He would prefer to have had the ancient model of the John Chrysostom, for example, that we open our homes up instead rather than having inns. And against that popular sentiment of his day, Calvin spoke against the civil government of Geneva and against the cultural, you know, mainstream view of Geneva, and urged that they welcome and treat as brothers and sisters in Christ those refugees who were flooding into the city at the time. So let's read a couple of these quotes here from Calvin. I just went to his commentaries on those two texts that we have probably, I think, focused on the most in our reflections, both in the biblical studies that we were doing in the New Testament, but also as we were reflecting on the church fathers and how they were applying these two texts of Scripture. So I just got that from Calvin's commentaries. So first, from Matthew 25, verse 40. You might recall this is where Christ returns, separates the sheep from the goats, and then commends the sheep for having fed the hungry, given drink to the thirsty, clothed the naked, and so forth. And they say, when do we do this? He said, you did this for me when you did it to the least of these, my brothers, right? So here's what Calvin says about that. Believers only are expressly recommended to our notice. So in other words, that the least of these, my brethren. Not that Christ bids us altogether despise others, but because the more nearly a man approaches to God, he ought to be the more highly esteemed by us. For though there is a common tie that binds all the children of Adam, there is a still more sacred union among the children of God. So then, as those who belong to the household of faith ought to be preferred to strangers, Christ makes special mention of them. And though his design was to encourage those whose wealth and resources are abundant to relieve the poverty of brethren, yet it affords no ordinary consolation to the poor and distressed that, though shame and contempt follow them in the eyes of the world, yet the Son of God holds them as dear as his own members. And certainly by calling them brethren, he confers on them inestimable honor. So in other words, he's teaching that we should have a special view of Christians. We shouldn't neglect non-Christians, but we should have a higher esteem for Christian brothers and sisters. And that this is not just a command and word toward those who have wealthy means, but it's also reassurance toward those who are impoverished, saying that Christ considers them his brethren and loves them and holds them dear. Now looking at Hebrews 13, we see some more continuity with the apostolic fathers that we considered a couple weeks ago. This is where the writer of Hebrews speaks about how those in the past, especially Abraham and Lot, showed hospitality and entertained angels unaware. This is that text, and it commands hospitality be shown amongst the church. this office of humanity has also nearly ceased to be properly observed among men. He's talking about hospitality, an office of humanity. For the ancient hospitality, celebrated in histories, is unknown to us, and inns now supply the place of accommodations for strangers. But he speaks not so much of the practice of hospitality as observed then by the rich, but he rather commends the miserable and the needy to be entertained, as at that time many were fugitives who left their homes for the name of Christ. And that he might commend this duty the more, he adds that angels had sometimes been entertained by those who thought that they received only men. I doubt not but that this is to be understood of Abraham and Lot. For having been in the habit of showing hospitality, they, without knowing and thinking of any such thing, entertained angels. Thus their houses were in no common way honored. And doubtless, God proved that hospitality was especially acceptable to him when he rendered such a reward to Abraham and to Lot. Were any one to object and say that this rarely happened, to this the obvious answer is that not mere angels are received, but Christ himself, when we receive the poor in his name. So we can kind of see some continuity there between the ancient fathers and Calvin. I'll just also to just briefly read the Luther quote here from his lectures on Genesis, commenting on Abraham and Lot, that God himself is in our home, is being fed at our house, is lying down and resting. That is when we care for persecuted believers. That God himself is there, eating and sleeping. And then Ursinus also has a quote there that we can briefly consider before moving on. He speaks about hospitality as a species of liberality, and is that by which we entertain strangers and travelers, and especially those who have been banished on account of the profession of the doctrine of the gospel, with true Christian charity, and with all the duties of hospitality. Or it consists in liberality and kindness towards strangers, especially towards Christians who are driven into exile on account of religion, or are forced to travel for the confession of the faith, of the truth. The extremes of this virtue are, on the one side, a want of hospitality towards strangers, in other words, a lack of it, and on the other, extravagance in not entertaining them. I think it should be extravagance in entertaining them, so exhausting the fountain of our beneficence that we are not left with those things which are necessary for ourselves. So in other words, being stingy or being overly lavish is what he's getting at here. I think I just might have had a typo there as I was transferring all the paragraph over. Anyway, so I think you get the point regardless. Moving on then from some of the Reformation fathers, you know, there's something that I was reading a bit of a critique in terms of Luther and Calvin and Ursinus by extension, where a lady named Christine Pohl, who has a really wonderful book on hospitality, although there are certain things that we would not agree with her on. She's a Methodist. But she speaks about how an unintended consequence of Luther and Calvin is that hospitality was separated from the church as an institution. And so, because what Luther and Calvin did so well was that they emphasized that the civil magistrate had a job to welcome refugees. And then, so in the sphere of the civil government, there was the calling for hospitality. And then in the sphere of the home or the family was this calling toward hospitality. But they didn't really talk about the church as institution. having a calling to show hospitality. And so her contention is that that was really absent within their writings, and that it was, you know, a shortfall, an unintended consequence, you could almost say, where they kind of missed something like that. She finds, being a Methodist, she finds it's a more helpful model in John Wesley himself. One of the things that Wesley did, you might recall from your knowledge of him, he was part of the Church of England, but he was trying a reform movement from within the Church of England. It was only after his death that Methodism separated from the Church of England. He claims that he was not trying to create a separation. People, I think, kind of argue about whether he really was or not. But what he did, though, was he created kind of groups within a church, which kind of became almost like a church within a church. And that church within a church was really where the true Christians were. And so you had the kind of the Anglican church that you went to on Sunday, and they didn't really believe that there were really true Christians there, or many of them weren't true Christians. You found your true Christianity in the small group in the middle of the week. And so that's where you have like all sorts of spiritual practices there that really are probably better for the church corporate than the church, you know, than like a church within a church. And but one of the things he did very well there in those groups are called band societies, was they had food together, and they had food and prayer. And through that, Pohl sees a better merging of the ecclesial, the church, and the showing of hospitality. So this group of people, sort of a church within a church, is then showing hospitality to people and eating together as they prayed and confessed their sins to one another and so forth. And they even, over the course of time, created homes for the poor, where the clergy of the Methodist churches would eat with the poor who lived in that house. So there'd be kind of a breaking down of boundaries there within that setup. Finishing off with a few more examples of a hospitality that's more in our day now. I'm calling this adaptations of monasticism. You might recall the monasteries were a place of hospitality. And then if you showed up at like a Benedictine monastery, if you remember, you knock on the door, what happens? There's an old man who would be have his room would be right next to the door, and he would cry out, I think it was thanks be to God, if you heard somebody knock on the door, right? So there are a couple of movements that are kind of adaptations of that sort of monastic living. The first one I would mention is a Protestant one called L'Abri. That's a French term meaning shelter, I believe. Is that correct? Okay, thank you, Drew. L'Abri was started by a guy you might have heard of named Francis Schaeffer. He and his family decided that they were called to move over to, I believe, Switzerland, and to basically set up a house that was just a hospitality house. And they didn't really know what they were doing. It became something like a monastery, more or less, like a Protestant version of a monastery. But it was a lot more geared toward like the intellectual elite, you could say. So students would go there, people who were academically inclined. It was a place to read and to study, a place of lectures, formal teaching, and also a place of your personal study and kind of grappling with big questions of the faith. They also had common meals there, along with those times of prayer every day, and mandatory work that was to be conducted on the grounds by people who were there. So it sounds very much like a monastery, except you weren't there for the rest of your life. You're there for a period of time to engage with big questions. Another one, which is founded by Roman Catholics, is called L'Arche, which means the ark, clearly a biblical term there. And this was started by a Roman Catholic man who was in France, and he became very troubled by looking around and seeing people around him who were intellectually disabled, and they were being put into like psychiatric wards and so forth, and the conditions were completely inhumane there. And so then he just responded by, he met people who were in that context and just brought them into his house, and then they became family. And so then he began something of a movement like that, where large homes began to open up. They heard about this and began to open up around the world. And now there's a few hundred of these sorts of homes where people who are intellectually, mentally disabled live there. And then there are people there who live there full-time called assistants. And it's a community that lives together in a shared home. Some of the things I think are really interesting about it, they're kind of, you know, thought-provoking for us, is that they're very adamant that the assistants are not providing a service, because they believe that they are being served as much as they are serving them, that the people who are disabled are serving them as well. It's a mutual transaction, and they're very adamant about that. And they also want to make sure it's clear that it's not a charity case, but rather what they're doing is just having relationships with people, and just they highlight being with people rather than giving to people, because they believe there's a reciprocity going on in all human relationships. So rather than seeing one person as I'm the helper and you're the one being helped, they want to very much see as both sides are being helped in a real relationship between people who are equals in the eyes of God. So I think a lot that can be learned from that sort of an approach. I'll get to that in a couple weeks. The last one to mention is something called the Catholic Worker Movement. This was inspired by the Benedictine Order. Remember that? It's knock on the door, thanks be to God, kind of a thing. The original kind of monastic order. But the Catholic Worker Movement, very interesting. They're kind of... I don't even know how to summarize their past in a way that's succinct. But what they did was they established houses of hospitality. They view it as being like a family home with one another. And they actually view hospitality as resistance to society. It's a very kind of a subversive approach to hospitality. Because from their mentality is, we are embracing and valuing people that society deems to be valueless. And so in that way, it's resistance. It's kind of subversion of the societal order, that there are some people that society says they're not valuable. So they'll say, no, they are valuable. So they live together in a house, a family home. And my understanding is that there's one of these homes somewhere here in Cincinnati as well. But anyway, I think of sort of an adaptation of the monastic tradition. Finally, to mention probably the most famous in our day, Rosaria Butterfield. And also wanted to mention too this book called The Art of Neighboring. Again, this is a book, Art of Neighboring. You probably wouldn't agree with a lot of it, but I think there's a lot that's helpful about it. It's not Reformed. Butterfield's really fantastic. I think thought-provoking. I don't think she's trying to create a one-size-fits-all thing for everyone, but she's trying to challenge us to think outside the box. The thing that those two books have together, which is why I'm kind of putting them together, is that they both emphasize our vocation toward our actual neighbors. So rather than thinking in terms like neighbor as a metaphor, like love your neighbor as yourself, they're saying love your neighbor as yourself has to include your actual next door neighbor. Doesn't exclude your next door neighbor, which is kind of how we seem to take it. Oh, love my neighbor as myself excludes my neighbor. It's everyone else in the world. It's the person over in, you know, Somalia who needs my help. But what about the person who lives next door? Oh, that's not what Jesus meant by that. It's kind of how we oftentimes take it. But they emphasize that, like Rosaria says, God never gets the address wrong. He's put you next to the people he wants you next to. And so we need to take that very seriously, to love our next door neighbor. I think that what both of them explain, and I think Rosaria especially helpfully, is that to make hospitality to make hospitality something that is a lifestyle or a way of, just a way of living, a normal part of your weekly existence, it requires us to restructure how we think about our lives, how we think about our homes, how we think about our budgets. It's challenging. It's certainly challenging. You know, we can't pack our schedules so full of everything that we can't invite somebody over to our home if we have an opportunity to do so. But the way that we have things structured oftentimes in our lives, especially in more urban contexts, is that our schedules are so jam-packed that we wouldn't have time for somebody who, our next-door neighbor, if they came over, knocked on our door, and were in tears. We have way too much going on in our lives to welcome them in for a meal. So I think that, you know, it's very helpful to think about that, to think about hospitality as weekly, if not daily, thing that Rosaria speaks of. To make it part of our budgets, to make it part of our ordinary preparation of meals and so forth. I don't know if people can go nearly as far as Rosaria without burning out and just, you know, going into an insane asylum, but it's at least helpful, I think, to getting outside of our comfort zone to be thinking about it. And one other thing I think that's a connection point between Rosaria and the L'Arche is that she wants to emphasize that guests in her home help out and that they contribute as well to hospitality. That even the recipient is also a giver. Just like L'Arche, I think, points out that they want to try to break down that barrier between the host and the guest so that both are seen as hosts and both are seen as guests of one another. I think Rosaria kind of gets to that sort of a thing where she says, you know, you walk over to her house, you walk in, and she's still homeschooling, then she might ask you to fold her clean laundry that are sitting on her kitchen table. But that's what you need to do while you wait for her to finish up her homeschooling and get the food on the table. Just start folding her laundry for her. So some helpful things, I think, to think about some of those various models to, again, help us to be creative and to think about our own vocation to show hospitality to especially one another within the church, but also to those outside the church. So we'll finish there and kind of revisit this in a couple weeks.